This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is the evening edition. I'm Uma Pagan, I'm PK Pagan, and you're listening to our ongoing series that's dedicated to the superhero. An in-depth look at how this uniquely American invention has grown over the last century to become a global cultural phenomenon. An attempt at better understanding this incredible modern mythology and how it's come to bear such an influence over our collective cultures. It is something I call When We Last Left Our Heroes. Episode 17. Was Superman a spy? Did you know that Wolverine of the X-Men was originally meant to be an actual Wolverine? Did you know that a Dutch inventor was blocked from getting a patent on a process because it had previously been used in a Donald Duck comic book? It's true. In 1964, the freighter Al Kuwait sunk off the shores of Kuwait. Within the freighter were several thousand sheep. Once drowned, the dead sheep would eventually contaminate the water, which was Kuwait's primary source of drinking water, and so the ship needed to be raised as quickly as possible. Enter Karl Krøyer, a prominent Danish inventor whose company was engaged to come up with a solution to the problem. Now, since there were no floating cranes available, one of his young employees came up with the notion that entrapped air could possibly raise the boat. The employee demonstrated by using polystyrol, these little balls used in heat insulation. An airlift was sent from Berlin to Kuwait with 27 million polystyrol pellets, weighing 65 tons. It raised the ship, saving the insurance company over $1 million in costs. Krøyer then went on to successfully patent the process in England and in Germany, but was denied a patent in the Netherlands. The Dutch patent office turned him down because of Carl Banks's Donald Duck comic book. You see, in Walt Disney's Comics and Stories No. 104, published in 1949, Uncle Scrooge's yacht had sunk, and Donald, along with his nephews Huey, Louie, and Dewey, raised the boat by filling the yacht with ping pong balls through a tube, essentially the exact same process Krøyer used in 1964.
My name is Brian Cronin, and I write about legends and myths and rumors on both my website, legendsrevealed.com, as well as my comic book website, comicsshouldbegood@comicbookresources.com.
That was Brian Cronin, and he's going to be telling us some more stories like that one. He's going to be helping us demystify some of the interesting tales, unbelievable anecdotes, wacky rumors, and persistent myths that have piled up in the 8 decades of the superhero comic. Popular culture and its influence has always kind of freaked out governments, and they've always been somewhat concerned about their impact on the youth and I guess the public at large. When I was reading your book, there are these fantastic stories about the times governments, or the U.S. government, and even the German government, got freaked out about superhero comics. Kick us off by telling us about the time Nazi Germany went on a Superman offensive.
Well, the interesting thing is with Nazi Germany is that they were really into propaganda. I mean, Hitler even had his own head of propaganda. So he was well aware of how the media portrayal of Germany was almost as important as anything else. And so when there was a Superman comic that came out that was just a short 2-page story in Life magazine showing Superman taking care of the world's problems if he really existed, they were obviously quite offended by that. So they wrote in the official SS magazine a rebuttal to that story. So they actually were so offended, they actually wrote a rebuttal to a comic book story explaining that, of course, it was written by two Jews, so that couldn't be. That has to be why you don't even have to listen to this.
And it's a great little piece as well. It's a great little 2 pages in that Superman finally goes, all right, I'm tired of this war. Let me sort it out for you.
Exactly. And at the time, that would be probably the idea for a comic book at that time to appear as a 2-page story in a magazine like Life magazine was a big, significant event for the comic book creators at the time.
Even if they didn't get Superman comics in Germany, it's likely they would come across Life magazine, because Life magazine was huge.
Exactly, exactly. Yes, that's exactly why. I'm sure that's why. Otherwise, I doubt they would have found Superman comics at that point, yes.
But of course, it wasn't just the Germans, though. I mean, the American State Department, War Department, there have been many, many occasions in which they've had cause for concern as well. I mean, in particular, the atomic bomb and Superman.
That's right. That's the title of my first book, was Superman a Spy? Because it references the fact that the U.S. government took issue with a Superman story that appeared that involved discussion of atomic energy and bombs. What's interesting is it wasn't so much that they thought that we were giving away too much information, is that they felt that by appearing in a Superman story, it made it seem like nuclear energy was a joke and bomb and stuff like that. And therefore, they wanted the American public to fear nuclear energy at that point in time. So therefore, they thought it was making it seem silly. So they went to go ask the Superman writers to change it. The interesting thing is that they presumed that the Superman writer was still the original Superman writer, who by that point had already been in the army for World War II. So they actually found him at his, I don't think he was actually like active combat, but he was on, you know, stateside. But they found him and they contacted him and said, hey, can you change this? And he's like, guys, I haven't written that strip in like a year or so because I've been in the war. Because at that point, what's funny is that the guy who wrote the story had based his whole story on an article he had read in Scientific American 10 years earlier, like 1933, about, atomic colliders and stuff like that.
Government sanctioned censorship aside, superhero comics have also come into odds with government officials. I mean, we've seen it with Fantastic Four and the Nixon administration. I mean, Captain America kind of gives up his stars and stripes, and that's kind of a little bit to do with Watergate as well. Just tell us those stories.
Well, that's right. Comic book and the Nixon administration did not exactly always get along. In the case of the Fantastic Four one you mentioned, that was simply a matter where comic books had kept the same price for many years by simply by shrinking this book rather than raising the price. So if you went to pick up a Golden Age comic from, like, say, 1940, like Action Comics number one, if you look at Action Comics number one, the book is practically 80 pages long. It's not the size of a magazine, but it's bigger than the size of a standard comic book now. And so over the years, they just slowly reduced how many pages were in the book and how big the book was. Eventually, though, once you get down to 32 pages, you can't go anything lower than that, or else the next step is 16, because you always have to go in levels of 16.
Yeah.
So from 32 to 16, obviously a 16-page book, you could not sell that. So they had to stop at 32 pages. That's where the standard comic book is nowadays. And from that point, they just had to start raising the price. Well, Marvel, in 1972, I believe, Marvel raised their price 25 cents from 15. At the time, I know now it sounds silly, but 10 cents.
That was huge.
But at the time, going from 15 to 25 cents was, yeah, huge. So DC very quickly responded to that by raising their books to 25 cents as well. Marvel then, though, because they were a smaller company and they had less bureaucracy, they were able to lower their books back down to 20 cents. And it was that year, in 1972, where Marvel officially passed DC as the highest-selling comic book company. And people tend to give the credit to the fact of that 25 cents to 20 cents change. DC was too slow to make the change. Marvel was not. But in any event, at that time, the Nixon administration had a inflation, because inflation was so rampant that they put a freeze on prices. People could not inflate their prices over X percent. So when Marvel went from 15 cents to 25 cents, that was over the percentage limit. So Marvel had to, so the Nixon administration took issue with that. And so it was a ridiculous settlement. Marvel just had to agree to basically add a glossy special story to the middle of an issue of Fantastic Four to make up for the money that they lost, quote unquote. 2 years later, of course, when the Watergate story was starting to crack in, Captain America had a storyline for quite a long time where Captain America was being pursued by some secretive group, the Secret Empire, and they were turning the country against him. Eventually, he tracks the leader of the Secret Empire all the way to the White House, where he discovers that the leader is the President of the United States. The President, discovering that, you know, realizing that he's about to be put, his identity revealed, kills himself in the finale of the story. So right during the middle of the Watergate, Marvel actually has the President of the United States kill himself in the Captain America storyline after being revealed to be a crook. Amazingly, the writer of the time, Steve Englehart, recalled that no one even noticed it, so no one gave him any problem over it.
Oh, if you try to do anything like that, featuring the President of the United States today, the Secret Service would be on your doorstep so fast.
There was a comic book that just came out last week or two weeks ago, a new Captain America number one, Sam Wilson, where in it they have some bad guys who've been fought. They've fought Captain America for like 50 years at this point. Sam Wilson, Captain America, goes up against them, the new Captain America. He goes up against the Sons of the Serpent over who are trying to attack some people trying to immigrate into the United States. And suddenly the conservative news plots are going nuts over that because saying that it's basically Captain America is fighting conservatism. And that's so can you imagine their reaction to if the President of the United States kills himself after being revealed as a crook?
I'm speaking today to Brian Cronin about some superhero myths and urban legends. After this, we talk about superhero tenets. Does Superman kill? Did Batman ever use a gun? When we last left our heroes, the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. Hello, super fans. It's me, Uma. If you were listening to this on radio, this is where there usually be ads and music, but on the podcast, I'll fill you in on some of the stuff you should be reading, watching, and listening to if you're enjoying this series. Brian Cronin's book is called Was Superman a Spy? And in it, he tells the story of more than 130 urban legends surrounding the comic book industry, from whether or not Stan Lee actually featured a gay character in one of Marvel's 1960s war comics, to the comic book character that inspired Nicholas Coppola's stage name, Nicolas Cage. And now, on with the show. Now, an interesting aspect of human memory is that it often plays tricks on us. Captain Kirk never says, beam me up, Scotty. Never in Casablanca does Rick say, play it against Sam. And Uncle Ben never actually says to Peter Parker, with great power comes great responsibility. At least not in the comic book.
So in Amazing Fantasy 15, where Spider-Man makes his first appearance, is the very end of the comic when he realizes that the burglar that he had earlier in the issue let go by him because it's not my responsibility, ends up killing his own uncle. So Spider-Man realizes that, oh my goodness, I have to be responsible. So all there is a caption at the end of the issue that says, Spider-Man, he just learned, with great power comes great responsibility. No one ever says it to him in the comic. In fact, no one ever, Uncle Ben does not say it to Peter in any comic, anything, until the 1987. It was the first time any comic shows Uncle Ben saying, with great power comes great responsibility.
You're listening to The Evening Edition and When We Last Left Our Heroes, and I'm speaking today to Brian Cronin, comic book mythbuster and legend demystifier, about all those tall tales and true surrounding the superhero comic. All of these characters, right? Everyone we've known over the years, they have evolved so much over the last 75, 80 years. Batman used to be incredibly violent, he used guns, he's killed people. So talk to me about the evolution of these characters, and do you think that the basic tenets are now set in stone? 75, 80 years later, you know, that Superman does not kill. I mean, is that something we're just going to live with now? Batman doesn't use guns, etc., etc. Are those principles kind of set?
Well, I mean, we just saw Superman kill in that in the most recent Superman movie, right?
I choose to ignore that. That never happened.
When it comes to things like killing and stuff like that, I find hard to believe that. I think there's always going to be a changing approach to things like that with violence, where it ebbs and awes, where you see, like in the 40s, it'd be totally cool for someone to kill, and then in the 80s, it'd be a lot less so, which is funny because the 80s you would think would be more violent. But for instance, I remember Captain America. I've written a lot about how in the 40s, Captain America was totally cool with killing. In the 60s, even when Stan Lee brought him back into the Marvel Universe, still, he would do stories set in the war, and Captain America would kill people because it's the middle of a war. Now, you fast forward about 20 years, and especially writer Mark Grunwald, in his Captain America run, he established in one issue that Captain America had never killed anyone during the war. He had just somehow managed to avoid killing anyone the entire war. And in fact, in a storyline in his book where Cap he's put into a situation where it's either kill a terrorist who's holding some people hostage or let the terrorist murder a bunch of innocent people, he kills the terrorist. And then spends the next, like, 5 issues basically crying over it, like literally tears at one point. And so that just speaks to the whole changing ethos of these characters. So I would not be surprised if a character of Superman kills. Not willy-nilly, of course, but him killing would not shock me.
Because, of course, in the early Batman issues, it wasn't willy-nilly, but at the same time, there's a clear demarcation. It's okay to kill the bad guys.
Correct. My favorite early Batman panel is a scene where he sneaks up on a bad guy's, like, you know, henchman. Look out the window where Batman's sneaking in, and Batman just swings up and snaps his guy's neck.
And that's just how it was done. That's how he took them out.
That's just how it was done, yes.
Comics have had their impact on the real world as well, just as much as the real world has had its impact on comics. We've seen the creative Wonder Woman, Lie Detector Test, and The Lasso of Truth.
Oh, yes, exactly. William Marston, he was a psychiatrist who for many years was developing what he felt was a quote-unquote lie detector test, which was basically a measurement of... Right now, the modern polygraph machine is called polygraph because there are multiple graphs that are used to test when someone is lying. He basically came up with one of those graphs. I believe the blood pressure test. He is basically, I guess you'd say, one quarter of the modern polygraph, which is, of course, amazing, yes, considering that he then had a character who had the lasso of truth.
And, of course, it worked the other way around as well. You tell this great story in your book about the Mexican police and ankle trackers.
Oh, right, the New Mexico police, yes. What happened was that we all know about when people are studying wildlife, they have those little monitors where you track a bird or anything that you release into wildlife. So one Spider-Man comic strip had an idea where basically the evil Kingpin, he puts one of those things on Spider-Man because he's like a wild animal and he tracks him. So a judge in New Mexico, in the United States, he was happened to be reading that and he thought, hey, that's an interesting thing to try with people on parole and stuff like that. So he went to a technology salesman and they came up with the monitor bracelets. They put it into test in New Mexico, and then it went to Florida, and it's been everywhere ever since.
I'm speaking today to Mythbuster and author Brian Cronin. After this, we speak comic book litigation. When we last left our heroes, the evening edition, BFM 89.9. Me again. Now, if you're a trivia buff, you also need to check out Brian's second book, Why Does Batman Carry Shark Repellent? Another amazing comic book trivia. It's full of fun and bizarre facts, like what comic book artist was the recipient of an on-stage thank you from Paul McCartney and an on-air apology from Johnny Carson? What superhero got his powers by being bitten by a mongoose? What popular NPR host was forever immortalized as a bad boyfriend in a notable comic book? And of course, why does Batman carry shark repellent? I'm a real sucker for these sorts of things. It ain't useless information, folks. It makes for great dinner time chat. Okay, so back to the show. In 1976, Marvel Comics was approached by Charlie Lippincott, who was, at the time, in charge of merchandising and publicity for Star Wars. George Lucas wanted Marvel to adapt Star Wars into a comic book in order to drum up interest for the film, and so he sent Lippincott to speak to Stan Lee, who proceeded to turn him down flat.
When Star Wars was first coming out, no one knew it would become a big success. And so therefore, but George Lucas, one thing interesting about George Lucas is he's a big comic book fan. I did one story in the book about the fact that the boulder scene in Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, Raiders of the Lost Ark, is directly influenced from an old Uncle Scrooge comic book. And George Lucas says this directly, that that scene mirrored a scene in old Carl Barks' Uncle Scrooge comic. He adapted that into the Raiders of the Lost Ark boulder scene. And so Lucas really wanted his movie to be made as a comic book. So he went to Marvel with a pretty good deal to make the Star Wars comic. But Stanley was like, you don't need this license. This movie's not going to be a hit. Roy Thomas, who had been Marvel's editor-in-chief for a little bit in the mid-70s, but by the late 70s was still working for them, he said, no, this is going to be good. We got to get this license. He did, and that practically kept the whole company afloat in the late 70s when comic book sales went down.
You're listening to the Evening Edition and When We Last Left Our Heroes, and that was Brian Cronin, who is regaling us with some tales of comic book legends, some true, some not so true. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was about comic book spats, because this is particularly fascinating, and because it doesn't seem to happen as much today. But back in the day, I guess when everyone was trying to find their own footing in the industry, it seemed rife with legality. Luke Cage, Power Man, the use of the word superhero, Shazam, Captain Marvel, and Superman.
Oh yeah, definitely, especially in the early days, National Comics, that's now DC Comics, they were so protective over their creation, Superman, that if you came up with a hero that was close to Superman, they were going to sue you. And early on, they were helped by the fact that they won a case against a company that opened up called Wonder Comics, where their hero, Wonder Man, and he basically, it was Superman, just called Wonder Man. and they were helped that it was pretty clear that they had just been told the artist, just do that. Will Eisner was actually the guy who, the famous later creator of The Spirit.
No way!
He was the guy who was hired to write Wonder Man. What's funny, my book, actually, this is something that's interesting, a false thing from my own book. In my book, I make a quick reference to the fact that Will Eisner did not, Will Eisner admitted on trial that he just copied Wonder Man. I think that's what I read in my book. However, later, years later, the testimony was actually finally, just like a year ago, the testimony was finally released, the actual testimony from the case. And in it, Eisner denied copying Superman. So what's amazing is Eisner told that story for like 50, 60 years. He kept telling the story that when we went to trial, I admitted that, yep, I just copied Superman, when in actuality, he had not.
You see, and it goes back to why these myths seem to endure forever and ever.
When someone maintained that story, he told that story repeatedly. He wrote it into comics. It was part of his legacy, and yet it was not true.
Yeah, and I guess that goes to Stan Lee's awful memory as well, and the kind of revisionist history that he often tells.
Stan Lee, when I was just recently talking to somebody about this, where Stan Lee, I think like many people involved in comics, when they were creating these characters, they were not putting too much thought into them, not thinking that they would be much of anything, that these were just going to be, this wasn't going to be their legacy, that people were going to forget about these things within a year or so. So I can see that probably Stan Lee did not, and many of these people have a hard time remembering exactly what they were doing in 1961, 1962, et cetera. What's interesting about Stan Lee, I think, though, is by the late 60s, early 1970s, when it became clear that comic books were having some sort of cultural impact, that's when Stan Lee sort of sat down and came up with his versions for each of these stories, intentionally or unintentionally. Because if you notice, yes, his stories all tend to contradict, but not after around 1970. From 1970 on, his stories stay pretty consistent. It's the fact that they all contradict each other during the 60s themselves. So yeah. I think around 1970, he has his story, and that's what he's going to stick with. I'm sure now that we're talking, it's 45 years later, I'm sure he believes those stories, no doubt about it.
Yeah, that's when the myth-making began.
Yes, yes. That's exactly when he actually said, okay, when he started doing college lectures and he saw all the interest, that's when he started like, okay, this is what happened. And that's what he's gone with ever since.
So, Brian, what is What is one of the most enduring myths that you've come across? You know, the one that just won't die, even in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Is there any myth like that?
I mean, there's plenty of them. One, this is funny because it's not a major one. It just amused me because it came up on my site recently, just like last week. Marvel has these characters called the Externals, where it revealed that certain X-Men mutants could live forever. And eventually they start hunting each other down. This, of course, is pretty darn similar to the Highlander films. So around 1995, Marvel had a comic series where they just wiped out every character in that, all these Externals. They were all just destroyed right away, all dead in like one issue. And so people thought, okay, Highlander must have sued Marvel, because why else would you just kill all these characters all at once? So I investigated, I checked with the people who, the editor of the comic and the writer, and they thought the characters were dumb and they wanted to get rid of them. However, I wrote an article the other day about the Externals, and in the comment section, people said, oh, I heard they had to get rid of them because of Highlander. So it's funny, on my own site even, people don't remember what I write earlier. So these things are sticky. These things are hard to get rid of.
It just makes for a far better story than we didn't like the characters.
Probably the best, actually, you're right, so probably the best example of that is the Green Goblin's identity. The long story for years about why Steve Ditko, the co-creator of Spider-Man, left Spider-Man was that he and Stan Lee argued over whether or not Norman Osborn should be revealed to be the Green Goblin, with the theory being Steve Ditko wanted to be someone that we never saw before, while Stan Lee wanted it to be someone that we knew so it would have bigger impact. This story was spread because John Romita, who took over from Ditko on Spider-Man, when people asked him at the time, why did Steve leave? He said that's why it happened. And so even though over the years, when you look at it, that doesn't really make any sense because A, Ditko says it doesn't make any sense. And B, if you look back at it, he had just revealed someone else to be nobody a couple issues earlier, and then he's not going to repeat that plot right away. But the most important thing is that around issue 25 of Amazing Spider-Man, Steve Ditko and Stan Lee stopped communicating with each other. From that point on, Steve Ditko would just bring he would just draw the comic completely, bring it to Marvel, to the production, Sal Brodsky, and then Brodsky would give it to Lee, and Lee would add dialogue to the books. So that they would not communicate for the last year they worked on the book. So therefore, they couldn't have had an argument over the Green Goblin because they weren't speaking to each other. So it clearly is not true, and yet, over the years, it keeps coming up. People keep bringing it up.
Because we love drama.
Yes, it's a great story. It's a great story. It is two men broken up over their view of the Green Goblin. It's a great story.
That was Brian Cronin, and we've been talking about the fascinating and often bizarre true stories behind the superhero comic. You can find his writings on both legendsreveal.com and on comicbookresources.com. He is also the author of the book, Was Superman a Spy? Also, don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes. All you have to do is search for BFM Heroes, and while you're at it, rate the show. Leave us a review. It really, really helps. You're listening to When We Last Left Our Heroes, the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.